Morning, everybody. I'm Tim Burkett, the guiding teacher here, and I'd like to introduce our guest speaker today, who came especially for this occasion this morning and this afternoon. There are still slots for the workshop that Tonan O'Connor is leading this afternoon from 2 to 5. Tonan has been the guiding teacher at the Milwaukee Zen Center for more than a decade. She studied Zen both in Milwaukee and in Japan. She's also the former president of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. And she came 2 years ago and gave a talk and led a workshop, and there was resounding positive vibes that came out of that. And so as a result, we're very happy and very honored that she's back. So welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Tim. I need to know if you can hear me over the air conditioner. So we have a terrible decision to make. Do you hear me? Or are you terribly hot? Or can you not hear me? Are we all right so far? Okay. Today, I want to talk about a very famous koan story that appears in numerous records of the early Chan masters. Now, I said, actually, to Rosemary Taylor, who helped set this up, that I don't like to repeat Dharma talks. I don't just sort of, you know, manufacture one and then spread it around to everybody, same old thing. But this talk I actually gave about 3-4 weeks ago at Nyoshinji, which is a Zen temple led by Nyoyu Anderson in Wisconsin. And I learned a lot from that talk, things that helped me understand what I'm going to say a little better. And also, it seems to me that this talk, in a way, bleeds into what we're going to talk about this afternoon. So that I think it'll be all right by itself, but for those of you who are going to be here this afternoon, it may add a little bit of understanding. I really love, personally, I love detective stories. I read them by the ton. And the more intricate the puzzle, the more I enjoy it. So when you listen to me giving a Dharma talk, it actually usually means sort of following me through the underbrush while I try to track down an understanding or a solution, you know, to a word, a phrase, a commentary, a koan, a teaching. But unlike a detective story, we don't usually find a culprit, but hopefully by the end of it have found a little bit of a little bit better understanding of the heart of the matter. And sometimes it isn't what you think at first. Dogen, who was the founder of the Soto sect in Japan, refers to this particular koan in one of his Dharma Hall discourses. These were short, formal talks called jodo. They were given almost daily to his monks, both in his earliest temple, Koshoji, and later at Eheiji. When I think about it, my mind reels because it means that every single day this teacher was giving something to those who were studying with him. It's not the once a week or once a month or once every 6 months Dharma talk, but he was trying to transfer to them two things. One was the vast volume of knowledge in the sense of book learning, that he had brought back from his early studies and from China. He brought back a book of 300 koan. And secondarily, to give his own interpretation of it, his own twist on whatever that might be. So, and they were short, pithy. They often ended with a question. I always had visions of these poor guys. It's dark, it's late at night, they're exhausted, they've been working all day long, and he finishes it by saying, take this out and think about it. You know, it's almost too much. But here is Dharma Hall Discourse, number 59, given from the abbot's seat at Koshoji, very early in his career. Dogen says, here is a story. Zen Master Faiyan once visited his teacher, Zen Master Luohan Guichen. The teacher asked, Reverend, where are you going? Faiyan said, I will travel around on pilgrimage. Guichen asked, what is the meaning of pilgrimage? Faiyan said, I don't know. Guichen said, "Not knowing is most intimate." Fion suddenly was greatly enlightened. Let's go over it a little bit and see who the characters are. One is a well-known master. The other is his student. And when the master sees the student, I assume, was extra special A, number one, grade A student, who did everything he was supposed to do. All of the traditional things, all of the right moves. And part of that, in those days, was to go on a pilgrimage to different temples and different teachers to expand your understanding. So he has his hat on, he's all ready to go. And so when the teacher says, "What are you doing?" he said, "Well, I'm going on pilgrimage. That's sort of, you know, the next step in my training." And I think the teacher really stopped him because Guichen asked, "What's the meaning of pilgrimage? Why are you really doing that?" as opposed to the fact that it's the next step in your training. And Fion was stumped and said, "You know, I haven't thought about that. I'm just supposed to do it. I don't know." And then comes the clincher, because the teacher suddenly said, "Not knowing is most intimate." So all of a sudden, from being just confused, Fion is hearing that that confusion, if you will, that not knowing, is it. And the story says he was greatly enlightened. Now, Dogen went on to say, "If this were myself, I would respond to Guichen. Is not knowing most intimate, or is knowing most intimate?" We have two possibilities here. And then Dogen says, "I completely leave the greatest intimacy to intimacy. But now I ask Guichen, what is this intimacy?" So we have a couple of questions here. And Dogen, you know, left his monks with these questions. But today I want to dig into it just a little bit, as well as there's some other issues raised by this story. To get at it, I'd like to first consider several different translations of the same story to see what words the translators have chosen and whether they give us, they kind of narrow down the intention of the language. You know, there's always a problem with translation. And people are always saying, "Well, what's the best one?" And I often want to say, "How do you know? You don't speak Chinese or Japanese or Greek or whatever it happens to be." And yet, we instinctively know, and I used to translate from French a great deal, you know that you make a choice between the word and the language you're translating from and your own language. And at that point, it can be quite easy for the translator's personality or preferences or understandings. You know, it's almost impossible to keep them out. I mean, the idea is to be totally neutral and it all just flows through you. Well, sort of, you know, lots of luck. But so anyway, I'd like to compare several versions. The first version that I read was from A.A. Koroku, Dogen's recorded sayings, Dogen's extensive record, translated by Taigen Leighton and Shohaku Okamura. Very large book. In the Shoyoroku, or the Book of Serenity, the koan collection most often used within Soto Zen, we do use koans a lot, Thomas Cleary translated the exchange as Dizong, who is actually the other name for Guicheng, asked Fion, "Where are you going?" Fion said, "Around on pilgrimage." Guichen said, "What is the purpose of pilgrimage?" Fion said, "I don't know." Guichen said, "Not knowing is nearest." Near to what? To whom? Intimate with what? In Zen's Chinese Heritage, Andy Ferguson uses the word intimate. So we have Leighton and Okamura using intimate, Cleary using nearest, Ferguson using intimate again, and then in the original teachings of Chan Buddhism by Chang Chung Yan, the encounter, it has a slightly different feel to it. "Where are you going, sir?" "I shall continue my foot travels along the road." "What is that which is called foot travel?" I do not know. Not knowing most closely approaches the truth. Aha, the truth. Oh boy. And then what is that? So now we have three phrases that have been used to describe not knowing. Most intimate, nearest, most closely approaches the truth. They're not quite identical here. So let's keep them in mind as we begin to think about the nature of not knowing. It's all too easy to assume it means a kind of blankness that throws away all cognitive thinking, and we're tempted to aspire to being rocks or dead trees or, you know, objects. You find it in a lot of Zen literature, and unfortunately, often rock or dead tree does not mean what we perceive as rock or dead tree. So, but it becomes very easy to think, okay, I won't know anything. I'm just here. Do what you will. I'm just here. And we become totally unresponsive. We cast away words, letters, and thinking. And we pride ourselves, I think, a little bit on our state of ignorance. Don't know a thing. I'm not touched by anything. In the commentary to Case 20 of the Shoyoroku, Nanquan is quoted as having harsh words for such an approach. Nanquan said, "The way is not in knowing or in not knowing. Knowing is false consciousness. Not knowing is indifference." Neither of those are going to be useful to us in our daily life. Wan Song, the editor of this collection, continues, "Now, when people hear it said that not knowing is nearest, and that this is where Fayan was enlightened, they immediately go over to just not knowing, not understanding." To understand, the problem was not just ours, it was theirs hundreds and hundreds of, you know, hundreds of years ago. The problem is we don't understand, or we don't know what not knowing means. So I think what we need to examine here is how both not knowing and knowing play a part in our relationship, intimate or distant, with our own world of interdependent existence. There's no point in my fooling around with, you know, definitions of knowing or not knowing unless they apply to what I'm going to do in my life. So what's the difference between knowing and not knowing for me as an everyday 21st century person? Unless we understand knowing, I don't think we can approach not knowing. They're directly connected. And Nanquan said knowing is false consciousness. And part of that is because what we think we know is our idea about something. And that can be an illusion. And not knowing is indifference. I'm just here. Nothing bothers me. I have complete equanimity. I don't care what's going on. That's no help either. So what is the way? Obviously, I have some ideas about all this, but I want to continue our detective work. And so I'd like to utilize another one of Dogen's Dharma Hall discourses. Here's number 447. Which is one of my very favorites. I use it all the time. Here goes Dogen. "I can remember," said Dogen, "Guifeng Zongmi said, quote, 'The quality of knowing is the gateway of all excellence.' Zen master Huanglong Wuxing said, quote, 'The quality of knowing is the gateway of all evil.' Oh, we have a little problem here." And Dogen goes on, "Later students have recited what these two previous worthies said without stopping up to today. Because of this, ignorant people have wanted to discuss which is correct, and for hundreds of years have either used or discarded one or the other saying." And Dogen goes on, "Nevertheless, Zongmi's saying that knowledge is the gateway of all excellence has not yet emerged from the pit of those outside the way. The pit of those outside the way, in which knowledge can mean facts, objects we own. Dogen goes on, what is called knowledge is certainly neither excellent nor coarse. It's we who say it's terrific or it's meaningless. It's there. It is a fact. And we respond to it by giving it weighting. We judge it, good or bad. And Doyen says, as for Huanglong saying that knowing is the gateway of all evil, again, what is called knowledge is certainly neither evil nor good. It's simple fact. We decide if it's evil or good. So what we're hearing from Dogen is that knowing in the sense of being aware of accumulated fact has no value for good or evil. We put that on there. In itself, it's neutral. Dogen goes on, today I, Ahei, would like to examine these two people's sayings. Great assembly, would you like to clearly understand the point of this? There's a pause in the text. I always imagine the guy's going, oh no, not again, I'm so tired. And there's a long pause. And finally, Dogen relents and said, if the great ocean knew it was full, the hundreds of rivers would all flow upstream. I just love this. I mean, just envision it. The ocean says, sorry, full. You know how the parking lots say, you know, empty, full, full. And everything goes, ugh, and it all goes back up the mountain. It's a very important understanding. In truth, the ocean neither knows it's full or doesn't know it's full. But because it doesn't know it's full, what we think of as the natural course of things, you know, continues. It's really neither empty nor full, but the rivers continue to flow into it. So I often think if the ocean knew it was full, the hundreds of rivers would all flow upstream. So knowledge is a barrier, or can be. Not always. So Dogen places knowledge per se outside the way because in and of itself it is not excellent or evil. Knowledge may be the very thing that becomes an impediment rather than a gateway. Witness the oceans knowing that it is full. Knowledge in itself is neutral. It is how we use it that makes the difference. So now suddenly it's all on our shoulders. We're going to have to make a choice. So the not knowing of the ocean permits the rivers to follow what we see as their normal course into the ocean. Though in truth it is neither full nor empty, if the ocean knew it was full, the hundreds of rivers would flow upstream seeking some other place to deposit their water. So not only when we know something and nothing else can get in, is in a sense that may be my loss, our loss, but that thing, knowing, bit of knowledge, is available to somebody else or in some other place. It's shunted off. It doesn't just disappear. So now I think we are perhaps approaching the meaning of not knowing is most intimate. Remember that I don't know was Fion's answer to a question seeking the meaning or purpose or definition of pilgrimage. If Fion had answered with a definition of the meaning or purpose, you know, I have to see 10 temples, I'm supposed to learn something at each one of them, I'm going to learn how the traditions are different, you know, there are all kinds of definitions you can give. But if he'd answered with a definition, he would have narrowed the nature of the pilgrimage until it was confined within his definition. Often what we expect is what we see and nothing else. So we, in a sense, our own definition of what's going to happen alters what's going to happen. Because we will often see only the pieces of it that conform to our preconceived notion. So, not knowing, although I think in the original exchange he just was sort of taken aback. He didn't know he was supposed to know anything, and he said, I don't know. But not knowing, he was ready to encounter the journey as it came to him, with no expectations concerning its meaning. He was open. When we know something, we're imprisoned within the limits of our knowledge. But the true way is without restrictions. When Fion and Guichen speak of, quote, pilgrimage, I think we can assume that it was a metaphor for the journey of life, a journey we all make. You know, it's fairly common for us to be urged to make a life plan, a business plan, to define our goals. But it is not knowing that is the openness that will bring us nearest to the reality, the truth of each moment. Now, I don't think this means meeting the moments of our life like blind idiots, but it does mean that our knowing of the next step that we're going to take must issue forth from a not knowing and open encounter with each moment. Until I have openly encountered the next thing, only then do I know it in the fullest sense. If we make that encounter openly, we may find that there's a far more interesting path than the one we'd been so determined on, just so completely outlined and settled in our minds. And lo and behold, here's something else. And often, if the plan is really rigid, you just shove away that something else. You miss the opportunity. And because we have a little time, I'm going to try to give you a quick run-through of my life. Because, very quick, I'm 79 years old, so you know, you can all go to sleep while we do this. But it has to do with expectations and surprises. My high school yearbook in 1950, a little small town, you know how they put in yearbooks quotes about so-and-so is going to do such and such? Mine says, will be a star reporter for the New York Times. I was going to be a journalist. I was, in fact, going to go to Syracuse University to study journalism. But I got a scholarship to Swarthmore College, which is a liberal arts school with no journalism program. Well, all right, I'd major in English. And then, because I was on scholarship and I had to work, I got a job showing, today it would be PowerPoint, but showing slides for the art history professor. Early in the morning, introduction to art history. I didn't know what art history was. I was dazzled. And I changed my major. So now I'm majoring in art history. And along the way, I began participating in an amateur theater club at the college and became smitten with the theater. Spent a summer working at the Tufts University Summer Theater as an actress. And suddenly, I'm going to get a master's in drama. And that was all going to lead. I didn't know where. I wanted the master's because I thought I needed a ticket. I might have to teach because the theater is a very uncertain profession. And I thought, well, if I've got the, you know, the piece of paper, I can teach. Well, that next spring, I was standing in the lobby of the little theater at Tufts University, and the door stuck, and I opened the door to the man I would marry, a scenic designer, run off into the theater and not accept the Woodrow Wilson scholarship that my teacher was going to get me to study in London academically. So now I'm in the theater. Well, at that time, our friends were all footloose and fancy-free, and you didn't do anything as conservative as have a family. Well, knowing nothing about children, we had both been only children. I'd never even babysat. We had a child. It was terrific, so we had another child. Then we moved to Chicago, where my husband was the operational supervisor for what we today call a public television station. And I was home with a couple little kids. So we and some friends started a theater company. Why? Well, we were going to be artistes. We were going to act and direct and do the plays we wanted to do. And we did. I mean, I shouldn't kid about it. We did. But at that time, I was going to be an actress. And what I had discovered was I'm an indifferent actress, but I was a pretty good director. But to have a company, well, you have to incorporate, and you have to keep books, and you have to send out press releases, and you have to make it happen. I was the only person at home with two kids and a typewriter and telephone. To my complete shock, if you'd said to me in those days, management, theater management or administration, I would have said, huh? I loved it. I was terribly good at it. And from there, my career utterly changed. I became a producer for the Theater Company of Boston, managing director of the Cincinnati Playhouse. Along the way, unfortunately, my husband and I were divorced, which also set my course, because if we had remained married, I wouldn't have had to support the children and therefore, you know, take the job someplace else. And I came to Milwaukee in 1974 as managing director of the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. I thought, well, I'll do 3 or 4 or 5 years here. You know, I'd been moving, you know, every 3 years or so. Well, I'm still in Milwaukee. 37 years later, I was at the Repertory Theater for 23 years. Well, Zen. I didn't know anything about it. I wasn't interested. In fact, I'm old enough to have grown up in the Beat Zen era. And they were being Beat Zen just about the time I was having children and thought it was a bunch of nonsense. I don't necessarily think so today, but at the time, you know, if you had said to me, Zen, I would have gone, oh, please, you know, give me a break. But through a fluke, the Repertory Theater began touring to Japan. And as managing director, I was going back and forth all the time to make arrangements. And on one of these trips, the managing director of our partner company there, I was going to actually a big experimental theater festival, which was great, but it was work, and I was tired. And so I asked for hotel recommendations in a city called Kanazawa, which is on the Japan seaside of the country. And he said, well, I'll join you. We'll travel a little bit before you go off to this festival. So we spent the night in a Zen temple, where he and his wife had, I think, gone on their wedding trip or something, out on Notohanto. It's a little weird. There's some people in the room who'll know if I say Sojiji Soin. It was old Sojiji. It was Keizan's temple, one of the founders of this sect. What did I know? But I was terribly struck by the whole thing and came back and thought, what do I do now? I picked up a little book on Zen. We're having this conversation today. None of that was planned beyond the moment at which something new arose. And I thought, I want to do that. It's been a great life, but I didn't map it all out. If I had mapped it all out, I mean, I wouldn't have come back. I would have just said it was great, the experience in Japan, that's it. There's nothing here. Forget about it. It's really important to be available when something springs up in front of you, even if it's absolutely unexpected. Now, I'm not suggesting that we lie about and wait for the world to, you know, call to us with something. But to be flexible enough to at least hear or see what's happening. Because then our knowing has not stood in the way. I think that our not knowing means, I don't know. Tell me about it. I don't know. But I'm curious. I don't know. What is that all about? And maybe once we do know, we say, no, no, that's not for me. But still, you know, I'll have people say, oh, I don't do X. And usually for no reason except I don't do X. I've defined myself by what I don't do instead of what I do do. And it narrows your life. It squeezes it down. It's more manageable then. Not so many new things come up. But I'm not sure it's rich or it's the life that the Buddha or the Zen teachers would wish for us. Because all of this Zen teaching is about opening up to the universe. You know, the old sort of Zen saw about your true self is the universe. So why do we shut ourselves off from it in a kind of, I just know who I am. I'm this little insignificant person. So for Zen, I think, although intellectual examination really has its place, I will not in any way downgrade its importance, but ideally what we know goes beyond intellect into the realm of experience. Or at the very least, our intellect knows the limits of its certainty. Well, I thought it was so-and-so. Yeah. Am I hearing something different here? Maybe I should expand my understanding. So anyway, our intellect knows the limits of its certainty and the areas that must be approached with not knowing. Because when all is said and done, however many travel brochures we read, the pilgrimage is not a pilgrimage until we set our foot on the path. It's all just a head game. So I think we can now go back to Dogen's questions to his monks. So let's take his second question, which I'm glad I have a piece of paper. I would have forgotten it too. but his second question was, I ask Guichen, what is this intimacy? The words nearest and closely approaches the truth have been used in place of intimacy. And I went to my dictionary, I'm a great dictionary hound, for the word intimacy. I found the definition, the condition of being intimate. which led to definitions of course, of intimate. And there are two of them that I found very helpful. Quote, pertaining to or indicative of one's deepest nature. Intimate. Or essential, innermost, intimate. It also implies close association. So to be most intimate is to be as near as possible to the true nature of something. Because we do not close ourselves off to this intimacy by a premature knowing of what we think to be its nature. That goes from everything to discovering the intricacy of a flower. At the Milwaukee Zen Center, we have quite a small zendo. And there's a little altar, and of course, there are flowers on it. Well, as the officiant, I go up, you know, to make offerings. And because of that, it's right there. And I suddenly think, good heavens, there are little spots and, you know, things you don't normally see when you walk by whatever that flower is. And it goes from there to the, I never liked him, I don't like him. And then you get, somehow you're forced into knowing the person and think, oh, there's a lot more to this man or woman than I thought. It's not like that at all. So, our knowledge hasn't closed our minds. I think this is what Shunryu Suzuki meant when he spoke, you know, the currently famous phrase, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, in the expert's there are few, because the expert knows what to do. I'm reminded of ages ago, it's an ancient sort of hoary thing about a scientific experiment that had to do with giving, I think, a chimpanzee three objects to pick up and giving a person three objects to pick up. So the person picked up this one and that one and, well, the chimp picked up this one and that one and got the other one with his mouth. Because it hadn't occurred to him that you could indeed pick up something with your mouth. I mean, unless you're maybe two or three. But I think it's also what Dogen was talking about in Genjo Koan, his very famous essay. He says, quote, conveying oneself toward all things to carry out practice enlightenment is delusion. All things coming and carrying out practice enlightenment through the self is realization. So if I go out to get them and order them and define them and describe them, I've limited everything is a kind of delusion. But if I let the world come to me and realize itself through me, suddenly the world and I are one thing and I'm a lot wiser than I was before. This intimacy about which Dogen inquires is life lived in intimate partnership with all things. It is life informed by all things. So now let's take on his first question. Quote, is not knowing most intimate, or is knowing most intimate? And I imagine there are a number of answers to that question. But for me, my mind immediately asks another question. Intimate with what? You know, it says, is knowing most intimate, or not knowing most intimate, or not knowing. I think we can say that not knowing, at least I feel, is most intimate with all the things, events, and moments that offer themselves to our lives. Not knowing allows us to be intimate with all those things. And knowing is most intimate or nearest to me with my particular and individual viewpoint. So after all, it's I who knows. Only I see the chair I am regarding as a chair. Chair doesn't see itself as anything at all. My understanding here is that Dogen is cautioning us about coming down too hard on the side of not knowing. Just as Nan Quan warned, and likewise not to be imprisoned within the confines of our knowing. Here we are again with the balance that is often called the middle way. Because I am intimately near to what, to my viewpoint on things. And yet, not knowing may allow those things to become intimately near me. So I think at each moment we must be aware that it is through our not knowing that we arrive at a knowing that may be most intimate. There's a pathway. These things are not separate. There's a flow to our life. We welcome something new. We learn what it is. Remember impermanence and change, the teachings of the Buddha. Everything's moving, and we can move with it. So I want to conclude so we have time for some questions. But let's listen just once more to the actual exchange. Guichen asked Fayan, Reverend, where are you going? Fayan replied, I will travel around on pilgrimage. Guichen asked, what is the meaning of pilgrimage? Fayan said, I don't know. Guichen said, not knowing is most intimate. Fayan suddenly was greatly enlightened. And in closing, here's my version. Where are you going? Into life. What is the meaning of life? I don't know. Your life becomes intimate with the great way. Thank you for listening. Okay, you want to stretch maybe before you, if necessary? anybody with, yes?
I'd like to ask about the relationship between not knowing and intuition.
Aha. It's a terrific question. The question, if everybody didn't hear it, was the relationship between not knowing and intention. I think intention, maybe I should think about this a bit, but I think intention sets the direction we're going. In other words, I intend to do so-and-so. But that does not mean it's closed in a way that I say I intend to go there as opposed to I'm going there. That's now closed. But if I have intention, I move in that direction. And there is a kind of openness that allows new things to happen. So not knowing, I think, can be a kind of quality we carry. You know, I intend to go there, but I don't know what's going to happen along the way. So, for instance, you know, I'm going on pilgrimage. Well, that is my intention. But because I haven't defined precisely what that is, all the not know, you know, the new things can arrive. But you're right, we have to have intention.
So what I'm curious about is, yeah, maybe a more a smaller
sure.
view of it, is that when you intend to do something, often you start doing it and you find it starts shifting.
Right.
Intention. And then the conflict is, how close should I hold to that intention?
Ah.
Because what's happening is you're, and I don't mean to say goal-oriented in a really concrete way, but it starts shifting. Now, if you don't hold to that intention, at least be in dialogue with it, you end up repeating or going into your habits or other things start, and all of a sudden you go, oh, I end up at the same spot again.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're holding something, but you can't hold it too tight, but if you don't hold it, you end up being at the same place where you started.
That's exactly right.
Mostly in creative acts.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think that, again, this business about not knowing or being open, we can't be so open that we're deflected by every old habit or every new thing that comes up. Because if the intention is to, let's say, create a certain kind of thing, I think that will hold, even though we're very open to all other, suggestions, provided those suggestions don't seem to fall into answering the goal. But the difficulty is whether the intention is very tight. I'm going to create painting. I'm going to make this picture. Then that's all that's going to happen. But if the intention is I want to create a painting that expresses, this moment, there is flexibility in there. So it really is a sort of balancing act between intention and interruptions to that intention. And if you're open, it's hard to to be open to new things, maybe not to old things, not to my, if you're open to something it's not my preconceived notion. Because what happens to me often, I start doing something and I think, oh, and then I think, oh, there's that preconceived idea about what this is again. Drop that one. But I think it's a balancing act because intention is very important or we wouldn't do anything. And it's a matter of flexibility so that we hold to the basic intention, but we don't become desperate to achieve or create or arrive at the point that's precisely what we had in our head at the beginning. And that's what's, it's always a kind of conflict or cooperation between my head, where I want to go, and what's coming up. Because again, I told you all those changes in my life. None of those shifts would have happened if what had come up had not answered, if I didn't have a response to it that was very positive, and so my intention shifted. Otherwise I would have just said, phooey. A couple of times I've been offered jobs that I just, great opportunity. I didn't want it. So we're always choosing in all of this.
More even more specifically, what I was thinking about is that when you're making something, you're doing a creative act.
Okay.
You really don't want it to be bad. You don't want it to be bad.
What's bad?
So you start, that's in your head.
Okay, all right, okay.
So as you start down that path, and your intention, your intention is new, so it could be a wobbly area you're going to.
Uh-huh.
You find that your habits say, you know that will succeed. This way will help. And so to hold, so you have to want to hold this thing, because you really want to get to maybe what may be bad, may not be bad. You don't know what it is, but you haven't gotten yourself there. And yet as it starts to be like, where am I?
Yeah.
You go to what you know.
So what you're saying is the problem of what we know to be successful. I mean, if I want it to be good, well, I know this is good. So how do I accept the idea there might be...
The intention, but then, wait a minute, how are you hoping?
Yeah. Well, if I know this is good, then there's a real struggle to say, well, if I don't do that, what else might be good? Because you're dropping, you're losing your attachment to the thing you know will work. The same thing is true in cooking. I know if I add this herb, it'll be great. I don't have any right now. Oh, dear. Is it a total failure, or is there, you know, can I take the chance with something else? That's very helpful, because it is about losing the attachment to what I know will work, because I hate to, quote, fail. And then we get into the, you know, what is failure and so on. And the Heart Sutra says there's nothing to attain. And I've always found that incredibly liberating, because nothing to attain, there's nothing to lose. If there's no success, there's no failure. So there's nothing to attain and, you know, have it. That will go as well. Because the definition, let's say, you know, paintings that were very popular 15 years ago, nobody cares about them anymore. Things that were very popular 60 years ago suddenly are back in. I mean, it's, you know, what's good really changes. The thing I think that doesn't change, to go back to the painting, I guess I'm just using painting because I'm interested in them, but the skill of the artist doesn't change. You know, isn't, you could say, I really hate that painting, but look at the work. Look at, it's very successful in that sense. I remember when I was in art history class, I still don't care much for him, but I hated Rubens. All those enormous Gothic ladies. But I thought, of course, I should really love him because he was, you know, a great artist. And one day, my teacher said to me, look, my name at that time was Sally. Look, Sally, you don't have to like Rubens. You do have to recognize that he's a great artist. And I suddenly thought, oh, you know, these are not the same. So when you're hoping to be successful, is it to be acceptable or accepted? Is it to be successful in your terms? And how much do I care about how really, I mean, how well I paint, you know, how what kind of technique I've got? And that's not true for painting, it's for anything, you know. So there are a lot of levels to that. But I think it's always a kind of transaction and a willingness, if we're going to be a little daring, to kind of say, okay, I'm going to set what I know will work over here, nervously, but I'm going to put it over here, and I'm going to try these other options. It's a complicated thing. No question about it. Yes?
Yeah, I continue with that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually hearing something you said earlier, talk about the intellect, and that was the limitation of the intellect. To me, that, I would say it's more the intuition.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's more the limitation of the intellect. More like intelligent work and intuition process.
I think that's a much better way of putting it. For those who, if you couldn't hear, he was saying, you know, I said something about your intellect should know its own limitations. And what he's saying is that your intuition will recognize the, if you're really aware, your intuition will recognize the limitations of your intellect. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also, in this process of sorting out decisions in your life, to me, that's an intuitive process, too.
Yes.
Things come up, you know, intuitively, that seems like
yep. I think that's very correct, because it has to do with affinity, which is a hard thing to describe. But, you know, again, going back to the choice in college, I felt an enormous affinity for visual art, never having really been exposed to it. And so I wanted to major in it. Well, there's no profession, I mean, there's no future in that. There was maybe a future if I were going to go to newspaper work or something at that time. But the sense of affinity for something, if it's truly powerful and not just a passing thing, it's your intuition, and I think it's where we do go. I agree with you very strongly. Yes?
Where does that intuition come from?
Why me? It's a great question. I'm not sure I know, although I think it's a little bit like prajna. Because prajna, at least one way of looking at it, is an intuitive knowing of what's appropriate right now. because we're truly in touch with our circumstances. So I think the intuition that provides affinity has to do with an accumulation of experience and personality and all kinds of things, which acts as a kind of agent of response. That's all I can say. I don't think it comes from, you know, some, I mean, maybe a scientist would say it comes from some, you know, part of your brain, it may. But I don't think it comes and says, I'm intuition. It's simply that everything about you comes together and coalesces in, I like that, you know, intuitively, and I can't tell you why. So I think it's an action of a relationship. And in a way, there is a kind of mystery, I think, in what we practice. Because, and I'm going to talk about this afternoon, we talk about a great deal of Zen literature and Buddhist literature speaks about Nagarjuna's two truths. That there is an ultimate truth in which we all share an undifferentiated essence. Nothing's defined there. We can't know it. And yet, you might call it existence. We all share existence. I share existence with this cup. And at the same time, the only way we can know what there is what's called the relative world or conditioned world, the room we're sitting here right now with people. And we will be taught that part of awakening is to have a sense that all of this everyday relative stuff we live in, which is all defined and described and conditioned, is the ultimate. Because the ultimate, it's the two ways of looking at reality, and they are never separate, because the essence or existence of things is only known through the things themselves. But the things themselves always have this mysterious element, which is, I share existence with this cup. We are related in some way because we are. It's a mystery. And I think we sort of intuit it, because we sense in our relationship to things that we're all here together. And then our minds go someplace else and we think we all have our separate stuff. And so intuition is part of that kind of mystery. You know, we talk a lot about everything being ordinary. I agree, everything is ordinary. But I read somewhere, somebody, probably Dogen, but somebody saying that, you know, all you know is that the ordinary is not sacred. What you don't know is that the sacred is ordinary. You know, it's all a piece. Yes.
And then there is a action.
Mm-hmm.
So a choice is being made.
Yes.
And this choice, it sounds like you're saying, is something that comes from intuitive apprehension of things as they are.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this intuition comes from a knowledge base that underlies common existence amongst us all.
Well, I don't know that that's a knowledge base.
Or what that you use for a shared existence.
Yes.
So I guess my next question is, how is that different from the kind of metaphysics of underlying antinomianship or
That doesn't happen. That's one of the difficulties we have in our studies, I think, because we've developed the Dharmakaya, which is the metaphysical world, for this calm, quiescent thing that does not change. But you see, you heard me use the word thing. Now we're in trouble. And it's from that a lot, various streams or strains of Buddhism have kind of gone off into the Tathagata Garbha, for instance, which says, I have Buddha nature inside me, it's a thing, which the Buddha himself, he didn't say that. But because there's an instinctive desire to be able to grasp something, to say that this Dharmakaya, this is not graspable because we can't exist there. Somebody said to me once, if I could just get to the absolute. And I said, you can't, because you wouldn't be there. There's no differentiation. I mean, there's no you. So forget it. You're not going to see it. And so, we take it on faith because it's manifesting in its differentiated form all the time. But the difficulty becomes that we have to remember, as Buddhists, I think, to say, yes, that's one viewpoint on what is, that one way of looking at it. But that is not like God, because however you might describe God, God, or a God, has intention and a plan. Is active, in other words, is making things happen. But this is simply one side of our nature, which is the undifferentiated side, the thing we share with all things. So you have to be very careful, because there's a kind of instinctual desire to make it into something, and we trip up on that a lot, I think. I know Sawaki Roshi said in something I read once that you know, people are made crazy by the fact that we're always talking about Buddha or Dharmakaya, Buddha, as inexpressible, unknowable, inconceivable, ungraspable. And he said, perhaps that's because it is everything, and our minds can't go there. It is everything in relation to everything, always changing, always moving. It's a process, and we can't grasp a process. The process is always there. It doesn't change. It's quiet. But it's difficult for us to grasp it, so we end up kind of giving it, you know, status. And it's a little hard. Because you're right, metaphysically, we suddenly have something that's creeping toward a soul or God or whatever, you know, because we're giving it an active nature. You know, so that I think what he really grasped, I mean, who am I to say, but I think what the Buddha really grasped is that it is, the only reality is this endless process, and it's not something you can grasp or describe except as you see it working. This is why we say emptiness is form and form is emptiness. Emptiness is a buzzword for interdependence and impermanence, you know, working together. Which means nothing is fixed. It's empty of fixed being. Well, how do I know that's true? I only know it because something that is form changes. And the nature of form is to change. So form is a representation of emptiness. And when we say emptiness, we can't know it without form. They're absolutely, and this is why Dogen said when you say one, you've said the other. And when you say form, well, you've implied emptiness because this cup is going to break, it's going to change. We'll try not to break it right now. And when you say emptiness, you can't know what that is. You can't know change or impermanence unless there's something to do that. So they're locked together. To me, it's a wonderfully clever way of relating a process to things, showing how we interrelate. We are representations of the process in our form, and you know. So it's but you're right. It's a little like it's you know, we have to. We tend to sometimes sail kind of close to the wind when we get into that one. And, so, yes. Oh wait, excuse me. This lady first. Yeah.
So I'm a writer, and with you studying English and translating, and also bringing up translations, I'm curious if you would accept the idea of saying that this can be summed up as a leap of faith when you talk about not knowing, or would you be picky about those words?
Wait a minute. When you, not knowing is a leap of faith?
Yeah. Would you compare what you've said by going out into the world and being accepting not knowing? Mm-hmm. Would you accept the term taking a leap of faith as similar, or not?
Let me think. It's a good question. I'm going to hedge here, maybe, but only in the sense that it's a leap of faith to have faith that there may be more out there than I already know about. Is that a reasonable way of putting it?
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, yes, it's a leap of faith that that there is more than I know. And so I'm willing to try to get off my duff and get out there. Yeah, I think so, in that sense. But it's not in faith that what's out there is going to be great for me or wonderful for me, or, you know. I don't have faith in its benefits to me. I just have faith there may be more there. So I kept having my head turned. Was anything over here before? Are you okay? Well, then, yes. Yeah, well, faith that this process is happening, you know. I also think that there's another additional definition of faith that has to do with trust. And trust, at least for a Buddhist, has to come through testing. The Buddha said we have to test it all. But that if you really are trying to experience your Buddhist understandings, that experience can bring a level of trust that you might say is, I have faith in it. It's like, you know, I have I'm trying to think of an everyday example. I have faith that a telephone might ring at any moment. Let's say I had my car repaired by a mechanic I really trust. So I have faith that it's going to be okay now. You know, I mean, I have a kind of acceptance. So in addition to the faith in the moment and the process, which is most important, I think there's this secondary understanding that my faith is not blind belief. It comes out of experience. It comes out of testing. And so now I sort of trust that what I feel is true. I think we're kind of running out of time, but are we? Is that it? All right. Thank you very, very much.